Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. The Food and Agriculture Organization of the United Nations has predicted that we will have to double the amount of food production by 2050 to feed the world. And that 70% of that increase has to come from technology and efficiencies as the amount of land and water is limited. How in the world can we make that happen at a sufficient rate and keep our food safe and secure for those coming generations? Large-scale farming operations, raising everything from soybeans to animals for food, have been a growing, and that's no pun intended, part of the solution in recent decades. At the same time, the local food movement, the organic food movement, the ecological food movement persists. Joining us now to talk about how to make enough food that is safe for us and for the earth is Nicolette Hahn-Nyman. She's an author, attorney, and livestock rancher and regular blogger in the food section for the online Atlantic Monthly. Welcome to the show, Nicolette.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
You're a longtime vegetarian and a rancher in California, and you worked some years as a lawyer for the environmental organization Waterkeeper Alliance. These days, we're often talking about feeding the world at the same time that we talk about things like the locavore movement, the local food movement. Are the two issues compatible?
Yeah, well, I do think it's important to remember you're not talking about either or. You know, it often gets portrayed as these are, you know, completely different. They are divergent directions, but I think it's clear that we will always have a global food system, and at the same time, we need to have more of a local food system. So there's a much greater percentage of our food that can be provided through local production. That's an idea that was kind of abandoned for a few decades, but I think is being, you know, rediscovered as an important part of the food system. It doesn't mean the global food system will go away. That's definitely going to continue.
Do you think that the global food system, or let's talk about large-scale farming right now, a lot of people are just either for or against. Is it that simple in your mind anymore? You've been covering the issue. You've been watching it for quite a while now.
Yeah, no, I do think, again, it's not so black and white. I mean, no matter, I know a lot of real purists who try to eat, you know, completely locally, and, you know, they're still getting their sugar, their coffee, their tea, their salt, their pepper, you know, from distant sources. And they're probably going to be eating bananas and things like that are coming from a long ways away. And, you know, I think that, you know, the reality is that we can do a lot more with local production. There are many food services at universities and school systems, for example, that are trying now for the first time in decades to buy locally. That's a really important movement towards reestablishing, you know, local farm economies. And things like that, I think, will continue to happen, and I think that's a very good thing. There are, for example, there are certain commodities based on the climate and the rainfall, the, you know, the soil that's available, whatever, that really need to be produced in certain geographies and are much less efficiently produced in other geographies. And so even though you have the transportation costs, it still ends up being a much more ecologically and economically efficient way to produce food. So I, in my own work and in my book, Righteous Pork Chop, I talk about the importance of local, but I emphasize that is not, you know, sort of the holy grail to me. I'm much more interested in a combination of thinking about local and locale, where you're actually focused on the sustainability of the location where the food is produced. I think that's got to be an important part of the equation as well.
My guest is Nicolette Hahn-Nyman, a rancher, attorney, and author. She's a keynote speaker for the Ohio Ecological Food and Farm Association's 34th Annual Conference coming up this weekend in Granville. For more information, you can check the link at our website at wosu.org/allsides. If you have a question or comment for Nicolette Nyman, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Not everyone agrees that organic is necessarily better, but most agree that it's costly to produce organic foods and therefore costlier to purchase them. How realistic do you see an expansion of something like organic farming?
Well, I do. I actually think organic is, again, it's not the absolute, you know, it's not going to be the solution to all food production, but it's becoming an increasingly important part of it. And I think it must be, because not only is there growing evidence that there are health concerns related to chemicals used in food production, but there's indisputable evidence. You know, I have to say that the evidence about the health is still sort of being debated, but there's indisputable evidence, and speaking as an environmental lawyer, I can say this with certainty, that that the ecological damage from the way we've been farming, you know, the chemical-intensive methods, that's not sustainable. You know, furthermore, a lot of times it gets kind of lost in the conversation, but almost all farm-based chemicals, all agricultural chemicals, are fossil fuel-based. So one of the things that, you know, some people are looking at increasingly is, you know, the sort of the fact that the fossil fuels are going to run out. We don't know exactly when, but we know that at some point we won't be able to rely on them anymore. So it doesn't make any sense for our food system to be so heavily dependent on fossil fuels, not just in the mechanization and the transportation, but in those agricultural chemicals. So we have to move away from those methods. And I think organic farming is part of that movement.
As far as large-scale farming goes, that's not a problem in and of itself, as you said earlier. Is it what they're producing or how they're producing it, or it just depends?
Well, again, I would argue, you know, there's a role for large-scale farming. Mm-hmm. But there are many problems associated with it. I mean, the primary one is the ecological impact of large-scale farming. When you have too much sort of lack of diversity in the farm landscape, you lose a huge amount of, I mean, there are many implications for that, and certainly for wildlife, but also the methods that tend to be used in that larger scale are those more chemical intensive methods. And they've been shown to lead not just to more chemical pollution, but dramatically we've increased the soil erosion in this country. So soil is probably our number one natural resource that we absolutely have to preserve long term to protect our food source, and we've been basically wasting it because we're by farming with such large scale methods and methods that don't use, for example, natural buffers like, let's say, tree lines and more grass buffers around farm fields, etc. By abandoning those methods, which we've done over the last few decades, we've caused soil erosion to dramatically increase, such that we're now eroding soil at more than 17 times faster than nature is able to regenerate it. So what we're doing is we're actually washing away and, you know, allowing to blow away the single most important natural resource that we need for future food production. Water and soil are two absolutely essential components.
Well, here we are at OSU in Ohio, at Ohio State University, in the state of Ohio. Agriculture is the biggest industry, bar none, in the entire state. Is enough being done at the university level to study these sorts of things and make them practically applicated out in the real world?
Well, you know, my father's from Ohio, and I used to spend all my summers visiting in Ohio, where his family was still based. And I'm from Michigan myself, so I really understand the agriculture of the Upper Midwest and really appreciate it. And, of course, I live in California, where it's also a huge industry in California, mm-hmm. the largest industry here as well. And you know, to me, 10 years ago or 12 years ago, actually, when I started working on these issues, it seemed that very little was being done at the university level to sort of try to look at more long-term sustainability in agriculture. I have to say I've seen a dramatic shift in the last decade because it used to be there was an outlier, you know, here and there, mm-hmm. and there was the occasional university that had either a couple of individuals that were studying sustainable agriculture. It's really become something that is becoming more commonplace, even in sort of big agricultural schools, typical agricultural schools that have really been teaching conventional methods. So I consider that a very hopeful sign, and that is mostly happening because younger people are demanding it. There's a huge interest in the, sort of the up-and-coming generation in a type of agriculture that is more based on human labor, human knowledge, traditional practices, more diversification, just basically things that are more human-based and less technological and chemical and machine-based. And so what's been happening is universities have been responding to that, and there are programs. I don't know if I could say at every major university now, but I know of many, many all over the country that are getting that are increasingly made pretty major parts of the agricultural program. So that's very heartening.
You live in Bolinas, California, where your husband, Bill Nyman, he's founder of Nyman Ranch. It's a natural meat company, and it's supplied by a network of smaller ranchers. Is that how it works? Can you explain to us how that operates?
Yeah, and that, to me, you know, the exciting thing, we're not affiliated with the Nyman Ranch organization anymore.
Okay.
But my husband was the founder of that company and spent his entire adult life building it up. What I find exciting about that network of farmers is because, to me, it answers both the concerns about sustainability and local food production and sort of being able to feed a nation and a world. What the Nyman Ranch Network of Farmers is a group of farmers that have agreed to sort of work together to follow similar practices, best practices for the environment, and there's a lot of emphasis as well on animal welfare, and to try to produce food as sustainably as possible, as humanely as possible, and then work together to get it to the marketplace. Because that's the really challenging thing for smaller scale farmers. They don't have access to grocery stores and food service industries, et cetera, especially if they're operating on quite a small scale. So they really need to come together. And other than through farmers markets or community supported agriculture, CSAs, there are a few direct to consumer methods. But I think the more important thing that farmers are figuring out is how to work together to get their food product to the consumer.
You mentioned as far as resources go, our soil and also our water. And, you know, you're from the Great Lakes region. You understand what it means to the Great Lakes region. But you mentioned earlier on in the program how some growers grow things that don't make sense for their environment. I lived in Arizona. I remember the acres and acres of flowers that were being grown down there. And of course, the irrigation was ridiculous. Is that still common, or is that starting to change? Or how? Let me ask you, how can that possibly be sustained?
Yeah, well, I do think there will be ecological and environmental imperatives that are going to make, you know, the less sustainable practices stop. And, you know, I don't think that's going to happen through legislation. I mean, maybe through legislation if you have water allocation, things like that. But I don't think we're generally going to be legislating those things away. I think they're going to be going away because the various imperatives are going to just make it clear that they can't continue. But I do think, you know, you do see, you know, rice production. Rice is also very water intensive. That's being done in a number of areas around the country that are not appropriate. But, you know, in general, our system right now, even though I'm a huge critic of a lot of what's happening in the system, there's a lot about the system that is quite logical. You know, for example, the upper Midwest has been the heart of pork production for, you know, since the founding of this, this country by Europeans. Mm-hmm. I mean, I say that because there were people here before Europeans, and I acknowledge that. But, you know, since the early days of, you know, sort of the United States as we know it, there were, you know, the upper Midwest was always the heart of pork production. Well, why is that? It's because the environmental conditions, the climatic conditions prevail there to be able to produce what pigs need to eat. So Ohio has been a major pork producer forever. So has Michigan. And of course, Iowa is the number one hog producer, always has been and will continue to be, I think, for a long time. That's because pigs really make the most sense from an environmental standpoint and from an economic standpoint in those states. So there's a lot, you know, that's kind of logical about our system already. And I think, you know, that's part of what I was mentioning earlier. Local is not always the most sensible thing. And when you're talking about, in particular, raising animals, it's much more sensible to have them in certain geographies. Cattle, generally, from an sort of ecological and economic standpoint, make more sense to have them in the far west. That doesn't mean you don't have any cattle in other parts of the country, but it makes sense to have the bulk of the production occurring in the far west, as it currently is now. So I actually see a lot of logic in this current system. And we need to sort of make sure that, you know, as we think about future food systems, we're recognizing those things that are sensible and not try to totally reinvent the wheel. A lot of what's happening right now is good.
My guest is Nicolette Hahn-Nyman. She's a rancher, attorney, and author. She's going to be speaking at the Ohio Ecological Food and Farm Association's 34th annual conference coming up this weekend. For more information, you can check the link at our website at WOSU.org/allsides. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
This is 89.7 NPR News, and join our station along with WOSU-TV for in-depth coverage and analysis of President Obama's State of the Union Address. It's Tuesday night at 9 on 89.7 NPR News and on WOSU-TV. And it's 51 degrees, partly sunny skies today with gusty winds and temperatures falling to about 39 degrees by 5 o'clock this evening. Clouds overnight, a low of 28. Support comes from the Wexner Center for the Arts, presenting the work of a dynamic Japanese dance artist, Hirokiyi Omaeda, in the Capitol Theater at the Rife Center for one night only on February 19th. Tickets and details at wexarts.org. And support comes from Marburn Academy, a leader in college preparatory education for ADHD and dyslexic students, hosting a community parent seminar, Correcting Persistent Spelling Errors, the sources of and the solutions to the problem. February 12th at 7 p.m., more at marburnacademy.org. All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back. We live in a world where 1 billion people are undernourished and another billion are overweight. There's a big problem out there. There are a lot of factors, food and food animal production systems, the environment and public health, economics and population. We've been talking about some of that with my guest, Nicolette Hahn-Nyman. She's a rancher, attorney, and author. Nicolette, once again, welcome back to the show.
Thank you. Good to be here.
And joining us now is Lynn Genter. She is a founder of the Clintonville Market and director of rehabilitation nursing at OSU Wexner Medical Center, where she serves on the Food Advisory Committee, Council. Welcome to the show, Lynn.
Thank you.
Nicolette, I wanted to get back to the point that we were getting at earlier, where you were talking about how it makes more sense to raise, to do large scale and do most of our ranching, large animal farming in the West, and then whereas it makes more sense, it's just the right climate, it's the right this and that, to raise pigs in the Midwest, you know, from Michigan and Ohio to Iowa, which is the number one state for hog production. But you also mentioned something earlier.
Pardon me, I just want to clarify. I said cattle. Beef cattle should be in the far west.
Yes, right. Beef cattle okay. In the far west. But then there's other areas of the country where pigs make more sense and
correct.
So forth.
That's right.
But you also mentioned earlier in the program the issue of fossil fuels. And
right.
That is pretty much what we rely on, and if we're in the foreseeable future, what we will rely on for transportation to move things around. And what you said made perfect sense, but when you think about this world we live in now and shrinking resources to move the food around, how do you envision that working in 50 or 75 years?
Yeah, well, I do think, as we talked about before, the growth of the local and regional food movement is part of the answer to that. But when you're looking at animal agriculture, the reason the equation shifts a little bit as opposed to when you're talking about fruits and vegetables is because they are much more resource intensive to produce. And so when you compare the resources that it requires to move the feed to the animals and then move the meat back to the place where the people are, it actually is infinitely more sustainable to have the animals in a place where the feed is. And so that's why having pigs in the upper Midwest makes sense, having cattle in the far west where you have lots and lots of grazing land available, and you can raise cattle in a much more grass-based way also, so you don't have to produce as much feed. That's why those things make more sense. But you do need an increase. You need a greater emphasis on local and regional food production, especially with fruits and vegetables. So it's really different depending on what food you're looking at.
Lynn Genter, it's pretty amazing, the increase in interest in the local farmers market throughout Central Ohio. And you were one of the founders of the Clintonville Farmers Market. How did that take off the way it did, and what do you see sustaining it over time?
Well, indeed, I think, 15, 20 years ago, farmers markets were kind of a novelty, and now they've become mainstream in almost any big community around our country. Mm-hmm. But indeed, it's the way people grew up. And farm markets were the basis. They were the gathering place in the community space where people brought, you know, for centuries, what you didn't, and people ate off of their land. When I set out to start, I didn't really set out to start a farmer's market, but a group of women in my neighborhood, we called ourselves More Than Gardening. We had more than our backyard gardens, or we were trying to, and we just started our own little co-op of trying to share among us. And we started to learn about people who had wheat berries, or people who were producing, all of us living in right here in Columbus in a community just a couple miles north of the university, didn't have our own chickens, but we wanted good eggs and poultry. So the four or five of us women and some men started a club, and we started to just travel out once a month. Someone would go up to the farm and pick up the poultry and the eggs here and go over to another part of the county and get the honey and here to wheat berries and things. And then we'd come back and on a Saturday afternoon, split it all up. And I enjoyed that, and we all enjoyed it, but it was very hard work, and we were working very hard to source all of that. So it was 2002, and I just started to think to myself, and having grown up in an agriculture community in Northwest Ohio, wouldn't it be easier if the farmers came to us? And I was in high season, summers, I was dashing up to Worthington or to the North Market.
There were already really good examples
of that
out there.
Yes, right on High Street in my neighborhood in the middle of Clintonville, and I thought, wouldn't it be great so to have farmers come to us? And I really felt passionate to this day about educating my community, the people, my neighbors, who would be running to a local major grocer in the summer to buy corn or peaches that were brought in from 1,500 miles away rather than having access to local food. So I started the Clintonville Farmers Market the summer of 2003 with just six farmers, and I wrestled and talked them into coming up for 6 weeks. And now we've grown to 60 vendors, and we are a plein air venue, and just this year started a winter market. So we're almost every weekend of the year except four or five, the Clintonville Farmers Market is alive and well and interacting. It's a beauty because it's farmers meeting the people, the distribution, it's distribution of good food at the smallest level. You meet the farmer who grows your food.
You're listening to All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. My guests are Nicolette Hahn-Nyman, a rancher, attorney, and author calling from California, and with us in the studio, Lynn Genter. She is a founder of the Clintonville Farmers Market. She's also a member of the Wexner Center's Food Advisory Council. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Lynn Genter, are there enough farmers to go around for all of these farmers markets, or is that part of the problem?
If you're a farm market manager, it's a good problem because there are more farmers right now, and it's been interesting to watch this evolve in the last, especially 15 years. But young people are wanting to get into the business, and older farmers or farmers who did, and it's a different kind of farming. It's not necessarily niche, but it is a smaller scale. So, and you were talking a little bit ago with Nicolette about monocultures, where one part of the country or a certain area of the geographical, whether it's here in the United States or Europe or Africa, grows just one thing. The farmers that come to farmers market tend to be very diverse, and they are not growing corn, wheat, and soybeans. They're growing things that you're going to eat, or the beef and the chicken that you're going to put on your family's plate. So I think in the end, there are more people wanting into the business. It's expensive. It's much like becoming a dentist or a doctor. The investment is huge. And it's sometimes a problem of connecting a younger farmer with an older farmer who's ready to get out of the business. And then there's a lot of work if they truly want, a young farmer wants to grow organically. There's a conversion process and years of preparing that soil appropriately so it grows the organic produce.
David in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome, David.
Hi.
Hi.
I think it's an interesting topic. One of the things I see is that a lot of these large agro businesses aren't willing to experiment, and then they keep doing the same thing over and over. There's a group called the Carbon Char Group, and I don't know if this woman knows the woman from California.
Nicolette?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know if she's heard of that, but tries to introduce more carbon into the soil, and it helps to create enhanced micronutrients and microbes in the soil, and improves the productivity and reduce, and actually takes CO2 out of the atmosphere. And there's a whole bunch of these types of strategies that could be introduced into farming that, like I said, a lot of these major corporations don't want to do. They just want to sell. A lot of them are like chains that have they're selling the fertilizer, they're selling everything else, and then they also own major tracts of land. So, okay. You know, you don't get a strategy.
Nicolette?
Yeah, well, I would tend to agree that I think the most exciting innovations are not happening by the large agribusiness corporations. They're very entrenched in the current system. They're very entrenched in, you know, sort of a pharmaceutically based, chemically based, fossil fuel based agriculture. But we're seeing that, as your caller David alluded to, we're seeing really exciting, innovative things happening on community levels, on farm level, and even at the universities. As we talked about earlier, the universities have become more interested and are doing more innovative research now. Iowa State is one of the sort of great leaders in sort of sustainable agriculture research, and there are more universities around the country. Here in California, UC Davis is doing quite a bit of very interesting sustainable agricultural research, and a lot of it is being done in other parts of the world, especially in Europe, because they've had the problem of, you know, very limited land space for a long, long time. So I think there is a lot of exciting innovation happening. It is not happening in general from the big agribusiness companies, but it is happening.
Thank you, David, for that call. We appreciate it. The number to call is 614-292-8513 if you have a question or comment for our guests. Lynn Genter, founding member of the Clintonville Farmers Market, and also Nicolette Hahn-Nyman, rancher, attorney, and author. She'll be speaking this weekend at the Ohio Ecological Food and Farm Association's 34th Annual Conference in Granville. Carol in Plain City.
Hi. And I guess this is for Nicolette, but, you know, I lived out west. My sister lives out west. And wherever you see grazing going on with cattle, you see nothing left of the grasses. And there's also been a war on what they call, quote, varmints for 150 years, if not longer, where they kill every possible predator, and including some that aren't predators, say, like groundhogs, prairie dogs, that I remember seeing a display once, I think it was in the Dakotas, and how much they do to improve the quality of the soil and the grasslands and things like that, but boy, they're out to kill them all. So how does this fit in with this, quote, sustainable ranching, farming thing, because I don't think that mindset is going to be easy to change. I mean, they're still slaughtering the few wolves that escaped from Yellowstone and things like that. And I understand there's a loss there, but isn't a lot of this land leased federal land, and we all own it and as citizens. So I'd just like your opinion on that. Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.
Yeah, well, those are real issues. I used to actually work as a lawyer for National Wildlife Federation, and one of our projects was wolf restoration. So I worked on that very issue. And I'm very familiar with, obviously, the ranching issues out here out west because I've been out here for the last 11 years. There's definitely a lot has happened over the last couple of centuries in the United States in ranching that is not beneficial to wildlife or to the environment. I do see, you know, again, I've seen a lot of shift in that in the last couple of decades. One thing most people don't realize is actually the number of cattle grazing on public lands has dropped dramatically over the last century, but especially in the last couple of decades even. So, there's actually less grazing of public lands now. There's much more management of it, both from the federal government and from individuals. There's a much better understanding of the need to graze in a way that benefits, you know, sort of long-term sustainability. You know, just probably the most important example of this is the need to rotationally graze, so move cattle from one spot to another, not to continuously graze one spot. So that's been a lot of scientific research and field research has shown that that is important for restoring and protecting the grazing systems. But there's also there's a lot of good research now showing that grazing is beneficial to the environment. So if it's done correctly, it's a real enhancement. Many of the areas that are grazed by cattle today were historically grazed by large herbivores in the natural system. And so the ecologies have evolved with large grazing animals, and it's important to maintain that. But you know, so these are definitely complicated issues. I see a big mind shift change, and not with all ranchers and not with, you know, necessarily everybody in the National Cattlemen's Beef Association. I don't think those are very progressive organizations, but I think the ways are slowly changing, and I think there's a lot of growing understanding of the importance of protecting wildlife and the environment in ranching. So I do see it as part of the future food system, the sustainable food system.
Thank you, Carol, for that comment.
I think,
Lynn?
I think I'll jump in here just a couple thoughts with this caller and David, our prior caller. When we think big, and Nicolette, you made this point that big is not necessarily bad. And I do see in our own community, and I suspect if I traveled a little further past Ohio, I'd see the same thing, but our grocery stores, our organic and healthy eating has become mainstream. So I always look at some of my friends who are kind of on the hippie and were in the early movement of food systems here in Ohio and say, you know, be careful what you are receiving, what you ask for. When I hear ads from grocery stores where they have a complete section called Simply Green, and just even one of the sponsors of this program, Meyer, talking on the radio and advertising their healthy lines of foods. So I think, you know, we have to, as always, proceed very cautiously, and the consumer needs to be wise and grab the best thing of both the local environment and then the things that are offered from the bigger systems, the chain grocery stores. But I just can't help but sit here and think about the community I grew up in, and there was a butcher and a small grocery store. If I named it, no one except the people who lived in Northwest Ohio would recognize that store. So we've come to a point where as consumers, we want cheap food, and that means we've started, and when you think about some of the practices then that make food cheap, they're not always the safest practices. So it's a real dichotomy is for any consumer or any person headed out to buy the provisions for their family for a week.
I would have to just tag on to what Lynn just said. I think the consumer is the single most important part of the change that we're seeing. I think there's innovation happening on farm, and there are innovations happening in restaurants and so forth, but the consumer is what's really driving that, and we're seeing this really dramatic increase in the consumer desire to eat more healthfully and to eat food that is produced in a more ethical way, a more ecological way, and just to sort of know a little bit more about where their food comes from and how it was produced. And so, you know, whenever I write and speak I always try to encourage the audience to think about what they're eating three times a day, where it's coming from, how it was produced, because it is the consumer that has the single greatest power and has been exercising that more and more. There's a lot more that needs to happen, but that what has happened so far has largely been triggered by that rising consumer demand, so it's incredibly important.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
There's plenty of death, corruption, and decay in Detroit, as well as hope and inspiration. And no one tells Detroit stories quite like journalist Charlie LaDuff. On the next Fresh Air, he talks about his hometown.
We're alive here, people. Everybody in Detroit is going to be fine. Still a city.
LaDuff's new book is Detroit, An American Autopsy. Join us.
And Fresh Air begins in 20 minutes starting at noon on 89.7 NPR News. Join us for All Sides tomorrow and hear about asteroids that come fairly close to Earth with news and social media manager at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory. And then usual and unusual gadgets with Geek.com tech blogger Russell Holley. That's Tech Tuesday during All Sides with Ann Fisher tomorrow from 10 until noon. And support for 89.7 comes from the Wexner Center for the Arts, presenting the work from dynamic Japanese dance artist Hiroki Umide in the Capitol Theater at the Rife Center for one night only on February 19th. Details and tickets at wexarts.org. And support comes from the Ohio State Ross Heart Hospital, helping to build healthy hearts with the 2013 Wellness Series. Heart disease is the leading cause of death in the United States, and regular physical activity is a great way to prevent it. Details about Ohio State's Wellness Series are at go.osu.edu/series. All Sides continues. This is 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back. My guests, Nicolette Hahn-Nyman, rancher, attorney, and author. She will be speaking at the Ohio Ecological Food and Farm Association's 34th annual conference this weekend in Granville. Go to our website at WOSU.org/allsides if you want to get more information about that. Also with us in the studio, Lynn Genter. She is a member of Wexner Center's Food Advisory Council. She is a nurse at the Wexner Medical Center, and also she's co-founder of the Clintonville Farmers Market. Give us a call, 614-292-8853, if you have a question or comment for either of our guests. John in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome, John.
Yes, thanks for taking my call. I just basically wanted to talk about some of the differences between holistic or ecological farming versus organic, sort of, and conventional farming.
Okay.
And basically, with holistic and ecological management, it comes to three tenets that have been agreed upon by most people. The first one is you don't till the soil. The second one is you don't use pesticides or any sort of chemical implement. And the third is that there's a perennial component to the system. So trees, shrubs, rhubarb, asparagus, something like this, that moves with the succession of the land over the long term, trees. So the basic consensus is that unless you have habitat on your land over the long term for all the things that want to live there, it's not going to be sustainable in any context.
Nicolette Nyman?
Yeah, well, those are I think those are terrific points, and I would agree with the caller that it's important to understand there's a difference between thinking sort of truly ecologically and just focusing on the word organic, because there is quite a bit of, you know, Michael Pollan has written about this quite nicely, sort of industrial organic production. I still think that's an improvement. It's a movement in the right direction, but what John is talking about, the caller is talking about, is thinking in even sort of bigger terms and really thinking about things that truly provide habitat for wildlife and will protect, you know, sort of the natural resources over the long term. And I have to agree with him that those are really important ideas for our sort of long-term vision for making agriculture truly sustainable and truly compatible with our ecology.
John, thanks a lot for that call. Nicolette, to what extent should we in the United States, we're the wealthiest nation in the world by, you know, any stretch, anybody can get anything to eat that they want if they can afford it. But there are lots of places in the world where it doesn't matter what you have, there's not enough food to go around. To what extent should the United States be concerned about the long-term viability of those other places on the earth where they're not able to produce food yet? What should our role be?
Well, it is very important to keep in mind, as you pointed out, that the food issues are very different depending on where you're looking in the world. So we do have an incredible abundance here, and most of the westernized countries do as well. And in fact, our challenge from a food system standpoint really is too much abundance. You know, obesity, 2/3 of Americans are now overweight or obese. So we're eating too many calories, and we're wasting almost 40% of our food is being thrown away. So, you know, there's this incredible problem of sort of overproduction of waste and overconsumption in the U.S. And then in many other parts of the world, they're struggling to get enough to eat. What many people would say, and I would agree now, is that the answer to that is not for us to simply produce more and more and bring that to those parts of the world. I think in the UN, the United Nations is increasingly looking more at the idea of trying to make those nations, help them to reestablish their own food sovereignty. That doesn't mean we don't do food aid, but I think the long-term strategy really needs to be developing agricultural systems, food production systems in those parts of the world that are ecologically sound and that will make those countries self-sustaining. And there is a lot of very good work being done on that right now. The United Nations actually has a special person appointed, the food rapporteur. His name is Olivier de Schutter, and I just met him in Baltimore a couple of weeks ago. His job is to try to help the UN figure out how to have an ecologically sustainable food system for the entire world, and one that where people are able to feed themselves. That's his emphasis. And I think there's more recognition of the importance of that. So I have to say, though, I was speaking at a conference in Germany in September, and there were people from all over the world speaking at this. And in spite of these differences of what's happening with food systems, I was astonished by the commonalities around the world. And one thing that we discovered was that there's kind of a universal lack of recognition of the importance of smaller scale farmers and ranchers, livestock keepers, around the world. So governments are still failing to fully appreciate their importance in the food production system. So we have a lot of work to do, and that's sort of common all around the world.
Besides the idea of fuel to move food around and the, you know, the obvious problems we'll have in the future unless we figure out a way to replace those resources, is the kinds of foods that we have access to grow now, the seed production or the numbers of seeds and different kinds of corn, different kinds of any given kind of agricultural product is shrinking.
Constantly. Yeah,
and there's different, you know, novels out there and so forth that look at sort of a post petroleum society and the method of the exchange, the thing that's of value at that point now is seeds.
Yeah, and just diversity.
Diversity, right.
Diversity is a really important concept that we've been losing diversity. And again, the United Nations has recognized this as an important worldwide concern. We've been losing not just on farm diversity, you know, just how much diversity is taking place on individual food production systems, but also the total global diversity of what we have in terms of our seeds and in terms of our livestock breeds. And the reason that's so important is because when we had a lot of diversity, there was a lot of resilience to the system. So whether it was seeds or whether it was livestock breeds, they were much more able to deal with new emerging diseases, new climate conditions, etc. And so there's kind of a growing, you know, voice that's been, you know, among a lot of experts that are sort of rising up and saying, you know, this is especially important because of climate change, because we know that the climate is going to be changing pretty dramatically. That's going to have a big impact on food production. So we have to maintain the diversity so that we're more able to respond to changing climate conditions.
We have an email from Lorraine in Logan. She writes, everyone needs to learn how to at least preserve local food, be it freezing, dehydrating, canning, fermenting. Even better, grow your own. Many can grow something, at least herbs and lettuces. Where there is a will, there is a way. Lynn Genter, I've noticed, you know, over the last couple decades at the farmers markets, there is a much bigger push to get people to participate in that part of the equation.
Absolutely, and I am grateful that she called in to mention that or emailed in, because it is key. In my own family, we strive to eat from our pantry shelf, and it's not always easy. There can be some long days in August and September when you're putting up tomatoes and corn, but I think that is today a family, that is the way to be an economical consumer and shopper. I advocate during high season, whether it's peaches or corn or tomatoes, if it's something your family loves and enjoys, snarf it up, grab it. And I'm an advocate of buying seconds. I'll be the first one in line at my farmer's market at the peach stand and ask ask him to save the ugly fruit. Mm-hmm. I'm going to use it for whether it's corn or vegetables. I'm going to use it in soups and stews in the winter. If it's peaches, I ask for the seconds. I'm going to freeze those. So it is, and it's a practice, it's an art, and it's a science, because it has to be done safely. My favorite kitchen gadget is my freezer. It is always stocked. I'm a lazy, busy woman, and I love to preserve, and we eat from our pantry shelf. My daughter and I were just conversing last evening about how many jars of tomato salsa and spaghetti sauce and things we have on the shelf, and feeling good about where we are at this point in the season. But it is definitely a smart thing to do. And one of the things, it can be really fun if you gather some friends around and do it together. So a big thank you for Laureen for calling in and mentioning that, because it is essential, and it's one of the most economical things you can do to stretch your food dollar.
A lazy, busy person, that does not compute. But getting back to the ugly fruit thing, we've been kind of conditioned, though, Nicolette Nyman, in this country, to expect our tomatoes to be perfectly round, to expect our Bartlett pears to be perfectly proportioned and the perfect color, with just that, you know, everything has to be so perfect now. And when people see something like an ugly tomato or a weird-looking potato, they think there's something wrong with it.
Well, I think people have begun to get a little more wise to that. I think, you know, the loss of flavor is the thing that I think people have begun to figure out is, you know, the cost of that. The sort of perfect appearance and the long shelf life are really things that were developed over the last couple of decades. And when that was developed, mostly from the universities and agribusiness companies, and as that was developed, flavor was lost. And, Alice Waters, the sort of, you know, famous chef out here in California that has really been a pioneer in sustainable food, she's kind of coined this term delicious revolution. You know, there's a huge interest in finding really good food again. And, you know, what Lynn's doing there, talking about and her work with farmers markets and bringing her own food into her home and canning it and freezing it, I think those are the kinds of things that more and more people are recognizing are a way to sort of economically, but, get really good and delicious tasting food. That's kind of the thing that was lost in a lot of the sort of agribusiness food production over the last couple of decades. And it's a lot of what's driving the interest in local food and learning how to can and preserve and to cook. Lynn kind of mentioned this, and I think that's a really important part of it. Knowing how to prepare your own food from scratch is an incredibly important thing for, I literally think every person should know the basics of cooking so that they can eat economically and healthfully.
We have a few more minutes left, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Lynn Genter, you are a member of the Wexner Center's Food Advisory Council. And before you tell us what it is, it did make me think about hospitals used to be, and sometimes still are, one of the worst purveyors of decent food ever. And the irony of that is just stupid. So tell us about the Wexner Center Food Advisory Council and what you're trying to achieve with that.
Sure. Well, I am a member, and I think I got called to that task force because some of the work that I've done out in the community and making noise about the way our patients were fed right at.
And, of course, you're a nurse there at the
Medical
Center.
I'm a nurse. I'm a director of nursing of our rehab hospital. And when I arrived there in 2005, I watched our patients eating three meals a day in their rooms by themselves or with their family. And, you know, probably, Anne, your experience of hospital food is right on. It came under a metal cover, and food was prepared a couple hours and maybe even a half a day ahead of when it was actually served to the patient. So we got busy trying to change our food system right there at Dodd Hall. And we brought in, along with the nutrition services, my Pat McGinty and Julie Jones, we got busy, and I said, what about a model where a chef cooks in front of our patients? So lunch and dinner now at Dodd Hall, the chef is there, the food is made, just like in a high-end restaurant in front of them. They get to smell it and savor it, and we smell garlic and things wafting through the building, which you didn't have necessarily have that experience until we opened up our cafe. So after I did some of that work, I was asked to join the Food Advisory Council. And what we are trying to do is, number one, prepare food that is healthy, nutritious, of course, and but now getting into choices. And one of the things that the medical center is doing is, throughout the campus medical center, we're opening up stations, breaking down our big cafeteria that would produce meals for 900 patients into smaller satellites, and allowing patients to have a dining on demand. So much like a hotel or a room service, they will be able to call and ask for their meals when they want them. And then we also partner that with more food choices for them. And certainly I take to the table the knowledge of organic food and local sourcing. And the medical center and the whole university has brought in a couple of our farmers that are large farmers that can produce and bring to the employees a experience through they can buy a share and have food delivered to them. So this is something employees can do, and they have the ability to buy a share and pick up food or produce right there at the hospital as an employee. A certain day of the week, they can pick those meat products or the groceries, the produce up in the high season, and carry those home for healthy eating for their own families.
Yeah, the hospital is a great point of contact for people to get them to rethink how they're eating and so forth. Food banks are another, food pantries are another point of contact, but one of the problems is access to cooking implements. Sometimes people don't even have a decent stove in their apartment to cook with. And Nicolette Nyman, long term, when we're talking about getting food to people and teaching them how to cook, you can lead the horse to water, but.
Well, I do think, certainly everybody should try to have something they can cook with in their, their dwelling place. If you're eating, Americans are eating, 34% of what Americans are eating today is fast food. So that tells you how far we've come away from cooking. And there are lots of people now that are in their 20s that have really never been taught anything about cooking. But what I don't understand is, why do we not have some basic cooking being taught in the schools? I mean, it was just a couple of decades ago. And I'm sure it is being taught in some schools, but that really needs to be universal again. And I think that everyone, needs to be making that as a fundamental investment in their household. If you can afford to have an iPod, I think you can afford to have some, frying pans. And that, part of the reason it's so important is because it just creates that connection with your food. I mean, we're talking about the food in the hospitals and the schools. It's not just about healthfulness. It's about the whole experience of eating as pleasure. Part mm-hmm. of what makes life worth living is delicious food, and eating food that you enjoy and is nourishing and delicious, all of it. To me, those things are all very much related. They're not, I really hate all these, ads and stuff you see where they talk about sort of the guilty pleasures mm-hmm. of eating. To me, food should always be delicious. I am very committed to eating healthily, and I have been for a long, long time, but I will never put anything in my mouth that is not delicious.
Nicolette Hahn-Nyman. I'm sorry, Nicolette. We have to end it there. Nicolette Hahn-Nyman, rancher, attorney, and author. Thanks so much for joining us. And Lynn Genter, thank you as well. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher. It's listener supported, WOSU 89.7 and WOSU HD1 Columbus, and streaming on the web at WOSU.org.
Support comes from the Wexner Center for the Arts, presenting the work from dynamic Japanese dance artist Hiroki Umeda in the Capitol Theater at the Rife Center for one night only on February 19th. Details and tickets at wexarts.org.